We will be jumping in 2 Corinthians to chapter number 10. We'll be studying verses 7 through 18 this morning, finishing that chapter up. As we do this, just remember the context of this letter, the main things being that it's a follow-up letter to a letter of discipline that Paul had written to the church in Corinth, and 2 Corinthians is his response to the response that the people in Corinth made to his first letter. It's a book of joy. The first one was really a book of discipline. Paul said some very difficult, some very hard things to these people that he acknowledged and recognized as being spiritual children of his own. These were people that he knew very well, people that he loved, people that he had discipled himself to some degree. But this is a letter of great rejoicing on the part of the apostle because his harsh words had brought them to the point of repentance. They realized their wrongdoing and they repented of it and they sought God's forgiveness and they found it. We do, however, realize that there were still critics of Paul in Corinth. You could label them as false teachers. They probably, some of them, were important people in the church. They had gained influence. They had gained some degree of authority in the eyes of the people. But one of the things that becomes very clear is that they are very much in opposition to Paul. And they've tried to paint a very negative picture of Paul to draw the people in Corinth in that church away from him. And let's read these verses 7 through 18. You are looking at things as they are outwardly. If anyone is confident in himself, that he is Christ, let him consider this again within himself, that just as he is Christ, so also are we. So even if I should boast somewhat further about our authority, which the Lord gave for your building up and not for destroying you, I shall not be put to shame. For I do not wish to be seen as if I would terrify you by my letters. For they say, his letters are weighty and strong, but his personal presence is unimpressive and his speech contemptible. Let such a person consider this, that what we are in word by letters, when absent, such persons are also indeed when present. For we are not bold with some, we're not bold to class or compare ourselves with some of those who commend themselves, but when they measure themselves by themselves and compare themselves with themselves, they are without understanding. But we will not boast beyond our measure, but within the measure of the sphere which God apportioned to us as a measure to reach even as far as you. For we are not overextending ourselves as if we did not reach to you. For we were the first to come even as far as you in the gospel of Christ, not boasting beyond our measure, that is, in other men's labors, but with the hope that as your faith grows, we shall be within our sphere enlarged even more by you, so as to preach the gospel even to the regions beyond you and not to boast in what has been accomplished in the sphere of another. But he who boasts, let him boast in the Lord. For not he who commends himself is approved, but whom the Lord commends. So Paul has his critics, and they have attacked him from a number of different directions. They have questioned his sincerity. Was he really sincere with the people in Corinth? Because he had made plans to come there, and then he had changed his plans and went a different way, and they weren't sure when he was going to be there and if he ever was going to come. The charge there being he really doesn't care about you, even though he's telling you that he does. So they've questioned his sincerity. They've questioned his motivation to the point that they've basically hinted at the idea that Paul was doing what he was doing for his own personal financial gain. They've questioned his qualifications. They've questioned his authority to speak on Christ's behalf. The truth is this. As Paul paints this in here, I know this is maybe a little bit kind of a difficult passage to read because it doesn't flow real smoothly like you find some things of Paul do. But the point is this, is they are leveling these kinds of charges against the Apostle Paul when they themselves are the ones who are guilty of these things. They are guilty of insincerity. They are guilty of wrong motivations. Paul can understand their mindset very well. And that is because of this. It's because Paul used to be one of those guys. There was a time when he was insincere. There was a time when he was motivated by the wrong reasons. There was a time when Paul believed and he had convinced himself with every bit that was Paul that he was doing God a favor by persecuting the church and doing everything he could to snuff it out before it even got off good ground. He was convinced then that he was in the right. They say that there was no one like the Apostle Paul that persecuted the early church, that he stood above and beyond everyone else. He saw it as his own personal mission to bring an end to this misleading teaching and religion. Remember the words of the Lord Jesus Christ, whom the Apostle Paul met on the road to Damascus. And he was going to Damascus for that same purpose, to extend his persecution of the church from Jerusalem to that city. Jesus' first words to him, "Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me?" What the Lord Jesus is saying there is this, is that when my people are persecuted, when my church is persecuted, you in essence are persecuting me. Paul believed before that time that he was God's man. He believed that he was doing God's will. He believed that he was earning God's favor by these very good works he was doing in the eyes of God. But then along came his conversion. And his conversion was not just a conversion, it was a transformation. The passion of his mind, the passion of his heart, the passion of his life completely changed. He flip-flopped 180 degrees from being the greatest persecutor of the church to perhaps the one who was persecuted the most because of his own personal faith and trust in Jesus Christ. These critics of Paul were claiming Christ themselves and insinuating that Paul, even though he claimed to have Christ, in fact, he didn't. What Paul does over and over again through this letter, I know that you've seen this as we study that, is this is Paul basically draws him to the carpet and says this, look at what I say, or listen to what I say, and look at what I do, and measure my actions against your charges. What is your conclusion going to be? Fortunately, these people in Corinth actually know Paul. They know the truth. Paul spent a year and a half with them before. They knew him very intimately and very privately. And they know that Paul, while he was there, that he worked. He worked as a tent maker to support himself so he wasn't taking money from other people. They know that he was a man of integrity. They know that he's a man who loves them a great deal. But they criticize Paul. These critics. And we understand that for some kind of sick reason, they really believe they are God's man and that they are doing God a favor. And they are winning God's favor by doing what they're doing. Well, we had a rather eventful week internationally. Early on with the storming of the consulate in Libya and the murder of 4 American diplomats and all the stuff that took place in Egypt and other places as a result or in some way connected. We wonder sometimes why some people are driven to the point that they are to do such radical and fanatical things. I would imagine for every person that was involved in that, if you sat down at a table with them and asked them to explain to you why they did what they did, their justification would be this, that I am God's man and God wanted me to do this, that I did God a favor by doing this. What motivated them? Well, we know that in some ways the particular film that made its way on YouTube that was done by some person here in the United States that criticizes Islam and Allah had something to do with their motivation. Now, I'd imagine that few people in the United States even knew about this video. Had anybody even seen this video? Have you seen that video even yet? Well, some of you have. I haven't. And I would imagine if it is what it's kind of described as being, most of us probably wouldn't condone it. We wouldn't say that's something we ought to be pursuing. But at the same time, because we live in a land where there are freedoms, and one of those freedoms is speech. That is wrong, is inconsiderate and insensitive as that might be, it's not legally wrong for someone to do that. We do have freedom of speech here. And that freedom of speech, my friends, is extremely important, and it's one of the things, the main things that people have lost their lives over repeatedly in the history of the United States, to protect our freedom of speech. But did the majority of people have anything to do with that video? Did the United States government have anything to do with that video? The answer there is no, that innocent people, in a sense, their lives were taken because of radical religion. Now, this puts us things a little bit more in context. And what I want you to do is picture the Apostle Paul as being like that before his conversion. That was him. But he wrote so much of the New Testament. And it is from the heart. We've talked about this. I don't believe for one minute that anyone other than Jesus has ever suffered so much for the gospel as the Apostle Paul did. He encourages us to do things like don't consider yourself important, and consider other people more important than you are. One of the things he's been doing in this letter is going to kind of come to a head in chapter 11, and that he's been demonstrating over and again just how much he himself has sacrificed, he's given for the truth of the gospel and the right to preach it, the right to teach it. And there were always people that did everything they could to close his mouth. Just like the Sanhedrin did, the very, very people that tried Jesus and found him guilty and conspired to have him murdered by the Romans, those very people continued to do the same thing to the early church, to Peter and James and the other apostles, and they were arrested at times, and what they were told over and again is, we're going to let you go, but don't you dare go out there and preach in that name of Jesus Christ anymore. But what they did over and over again is just pick up where they left off. Persecution, my friends, is a way of the church. It's always been around, and it will likely be around up to the very end. It's easy for people to believe that they are on God's side, and other people are the enemies of God. But We know there's a way, and there's only a way. One way, and that is through Jesus Christ. We know, we understand that there are religions that don't encourage people to violence. But even then, they will not save anyone. There is only one who comes to the Father, and that is the one who comes through Jesus Christ. End of story. Have your enemies ever questioned your association with God because of your Christian faith? I'm hoping that you can say, yes, I've seen that happen, at least a little bitty, teeny tiny degree in my life, that I've suffered some by the judgment of people because I was a believer and they weren't. See, Paul is willing to stand on nothing but his own reputation. Because what he does is just remind people of the real Paul. This is what you've seen. This is what they're saying, but it doesn't line up with what you've seen from me. What if we have to stand on our own actions? What would people say about us? I mean, what I'm saying here is, are we people who truly practice what we believe? And let me say this. I know that to some degree you guys are, otherwise I wouldn't be here. Our words and our actions, just like Paul's, are the evidence of what is in here. Really. Take all the fluff away. Take all this, the outer coverings and all of that. What truly is there deep in that heart? And how does it play out in the manner in which we present Christ to the world? By the way, there was one before Paul who challenged over and again the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the scribes and the priests, all of whom who were convinced that they were God's men, that they were acting on God's behalf when they conspired and murdered him. How deceived can the human heart be? That's a great measure of it right there. How could you be even more deceived than possibly that by killing the very person you've been waiting for thousands of years to appear to your people? Because he wasn't exactly what you thought he was going to be. When they died, and all of those men died that sat on the Sanhedrin, when they died, they were confronted. And let me ask you something. Were they confronted, do you believe, with 10 virgins, or were they confronted with an angry God? They say his letters are weighty and strong, but his personal presence is unimpressive and his speech contemptible. This particular passage has led many of us to the idea that Paul was a feeble man of very small stature. Very quiet, kept himself, not impressive at all to look at, not impressive at all to listen to. But what they're saying here, oh yeah, that's how he is in person, but give him a pen and a piece of paper and he can blast the best of you. In other words, he says one thing when you're not present, but when you are present, he will not say the same kind of things to your face. He does it in a letter. We've talked about this, that really there truly must have been a personal meekness, not weakness, but meekness and gentleness to the Apostle Paul. You've met people like this in your lifetime. There are a couple people who come to mind with me, and they're people who have been touched by God with an extra special measure of grace. Very, very gracious people, very gentle people, very kind and meek people. You've met Christians like that. I know you have. And I would imagine that for you, just like me. Sometimes I wish I really was more like that than I find myself to be. Because we know this is how Jesus was. We talked last week about how Jesus, you could get his dander up, and there were times when that happened, but it was never about him. It was always about the desecration of his Father in heaven. Don't mistake meekness for weakness. Don't mistake gentleness for wimpiness. These are things that are encouraged not only in the characteristics or qualifications of an apostle or a leader in the church, but of every believer. Just remember, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. It's amazing to me how it seems like anybody can come along with some degree of a dance or a story, and they can find people that are willing to follow along and believe it. It's very amazing to me. But people do that. Let me tell you, there are people that I know of. It makes me angry when I listen to their teaching, because I know it doesn't line up with Scripture. It just doesn't. It flat doesn't. There's no way to reconcile the two. It doesn't happen. And they're claiming to be speaking on God's behalf. That gets my dander up. Because I can take my Bible and I can show them specifically and exactly why they are wrong. Does anything get our dander up? That ought to. But how do we approach correcting that? Is it with a sledgehammer or with an axe or a saw? Or is it with a gentle word and a kind touch? Many of you know that I teach environmental science at CFCC, actually CF now, it's no longer a community college, it's a four-year school. But you're aware, everyone here is aware of some of the environmental issues, things that are issues in our day, and one of those is global warming, right? People really believe in global warming, and I'll just tell you what the reality is. This is more and more scientists are coming out saying, okay, we don't need to go there, okay? The other hand, you have people on the other end that are screaming, why haven't we gone there? We need to get there. We're destroying the earth. And let me tell you something. It's not a good thing that what we're doing. It's not good for us to be using energy like we are and putting the nasty stuff in the atmosphere that we are. There's 30,000 people in the United States that die every year from respiratory diseases. How much does that have to do with coal-fired plants that are pumping nasty stuff into the atmosphere all the time? People gripe today more about allergies and things. Probably a lot of that has to do with the kind of junk we're putting into the air. But there's a particular person who's made a ton of money over the global warming crisis, who I will not name, but you know who I'm talking about. The thing that gets my dander up is this. Is this particular person is encouraging you and me to cut way back on our energy use, to reduce our carbon footprint, and on the average, he uses 10 times more energy than any of us do already, and people listen to him. Why? Why in the world would anybody that really looks at this with an honest and open mind put stock in any word that proceeded forth from that man's mouth? because he wants other people to do something he is not willing to do himself. What I would say to him, I saw him, you get down here to where we are, and then I'll give you an ear. Till you do that, it's not going to happen. See how hypocritical the whole thing is? But there are people who love it. It has made this fella a ton of money. Don't doubt it for a minute. I'm not here today to tell you that there is not reason for concern. Don't get me wrong. There is reason for concern. But I will promise you this, that what we're doing is not going to put us into a furnace in the next 2 years. There's time to slow down, think about what we're doing, so we don't mess up and make the same kinds of mistakes that we've made in the past. Because let me tell you something, if global warming is true and it's being caused by people because we're burning lots of fossil fuels, guess who's guilty of pushing us in that direction? It was the people who were the anti-nukes back in the 70s and 80s. Because we wanted energy and there's only one other way to get it, and that was to go fossil. So we've done that. Now, you don't hear any of those people today talking about their part in causing this crisis, if it is a crisis. Paul's enemies question his character. Let me tell you something. If you're not, there's certain circles here. If you're not a pro global warming guru, then you're the enemy. And you're treated as such. And your character's challenged. We know how their character stands up when you put it just by a very simple standard of practicing what you preach or doing what you teach. Paul was willing to stand on his reputation again, on what people knew about him, the character they knew he had. And he wasn't doing it out of pride. He who boasts, let him boast in the Lord. I rub my elbows with pastors probably more than most of you do. You rub your elbow with me a lot, don't get me wrong, but and I probably don't do it near as much as I should. I should be a lot more active and sharing and all that with other pastors. I don't do that. I am very close to the guys on the examining committee. We've served together now for a long time. Most of those are teaching elders, and so we are very, very close. But I'm around pastors quite a bit, and I would love to be able to tell you this, as I stood before you today, that what I find in every single one of them is humility and gentleness and kindness, a real zeal for the Lord, but at the same time, when it comes to themselves, just real, true, heartfelt, no doubt about it, humbleness and humility. I have known some pastors, when I mentioned before, those people that have been given an extra smattering of grace. Two of the people that I was talking about there are actually pastors. PCA pastors. One by the name of Jack Miller, who is dead now. He passed away a number of years ago from heart disease and cancer finally got him. First time I met him was surprising to me because I'd listened to his teaching and I was familiar with people that were following Jack Miller's teaching a great deal. But the first time I saw Jack Miller, I'm going, this is Jack Miller? Because I had envisioned this big guy, because I knew he came from Wyoming, and that's where the deer and antelope play, and they make those cowboys big and strong, right? This guy was a weenie-looking man. He was a wimp. He was feeble-looking. He looked like if the wind came along, it'd just blow him right away. Let me tell you what, he had a heart for God, a gentle spirit. Let me tell you, his ministry touched lots of people, not only here in the United States. His ministry is the reason we have our connections in Uganda that we have today. You're talking about thousands of people that benefited from his ministry. But when it came to Jack, very meek, very humble, very gentle. Another one's name is Frank Barker. And I want you to know something. Both of these guys that I'm going to talk about, PCA pastors. Jack Miller's passed away. Frank Barker, for many years, was the pastor of by far the largest PCA church there is, Briarwood in Birmingham, Alabama. The first time I met Frank Barker, guess what my reaction was? This is Frank Barker? You got to be kidding me. I had been at luncheon, and there were a lot of other pastors there, and I was listening to the conversation going on after we had this lunch, and everyone's saying the same thing. This is Frank Barker? He's got that huge ministry, and he's not impressive to look at. He's not even that impressive to listen to. Wow. I didn't get to know either of those people too terribly close. I knew Jack Miller on a personal note. In other words, if he saw me, he knew who I was, and Laurie knew him too. Frank Barker, over the years, because I spent some time, I had the privilege that afternoon of driving him to the airport, so I spent 2 hours alone with Frank Barker. Maybe there were a few other people there, but he sat in the front with me, and so we talked the whole time. And what a sense of humility, what a sense of gentleness and meekness when it came to him and when it came to people in general. But when it came to the things of God, let me tell you, this guy's got fire. So I just want you to be encouraged that there are ministers out there who truly do have hearts of gentleness and meekness when it comes to so many things, but fire when it comes to the things of God. Talking not too long ago, there was someone that kind of watched Lori and I from afar about how we are with our grandchildren. And he came to us and he said this. He said, "It's been looking at this in how is it you can be so patient with those little kids?" And this is someone who has little kids. And we just started laughing because let me tell you something. I'm enjoying my grandchildren a lot. I would almost rather be with them than be with anybody else except maybe Lori. And Caroline, since she's here, I'll say that. But you know what I mean. We loved having our great niece stay with us for 7 or 10 days over the last month just to help out mommy. We loved it. We didn't want her to go back. I cried. There's a softness that comes, I think, in time, because most people would tell you that when I first became a believer, I wasn't that soft. Some people would probably tell you today that I'm not very soft. But it's one of those things that kind of grows on you, and we need to understand something, that Paul has been in the ministry for a long, long time now at this point. And I would imagine that at the very beginning, people kept Paul at arm's length because they thought in the beginning it was just some kind of conspiracy. He was trying to get into the church so that he could be an undercover agent and turn people in and persecute people and that sort of thing. But only time told that it was really true conversion, transformation, and so he became more and more accepted as time went on. That's the reason that he sees himself as having to defend his apostleship over and over again. It's because people still question it after many years. I met a young pastor many years ago. He was new. And let me tell you, he was a bit on the cocky side. He said to me, he said, "I took a church of 70 and I turned it into a church of 150. No mention of God, no mention of anything other than me. This is what I've accomplished since I've come here. I've taken a church of 70 that was dying, and I've turned it into a church of 150, and it is living. Because there were people questioning his ministry. They were questioning his approach to ministry. And this was his justification. And the justification is this, is look at the evidence. I've taken a church of 70 and I've turned it into 150. That means I'm God's man. I'm doing his work. And I'm doing it right. Don't question me. The very next breath, and you've heard me say this before, he said, we had 40% of our membership in church last Sunday. I need to understand, in some circles, 40% would be like phenomenally good. Because let me tell you, you think the voter registration rolls are all messed up, they have dead people on them and things like that. If you started digging into the membership rolls of a lot of churches, you'd find the same thing going on. Because the more people you have, the greater your success, right? It's very nice for a pastor to be able to rub elbows with other pastors and say, well, we've got so many people in our church and in all of that. And you can understand that. Because that has become, unfortunately, very often the standard that even churches are compared by. What is the level of impact you're having? And that is determined by how many people you have. I've been praying for that young man ever since then. We have had no more conversations. Because what it sounded like to me was this, is you say, it sounds to me like you've got a lot of people in your church that just are not very committed. People that come every now and then maybe. And there are people on your roll that probably shouldn't even be on your roll any longer. See, we purge our roll every year. We could have kept a lot of people on our roll that we've chosen not to leave on there because we have good reason to believe they're never going to be back here again. Whose glory are we in it for? Are we in it for our own, or are we in it for God's glory and for God's honor? Sometimes I wonder, guys, about me. None of you understand what goes through the mind, the heart of a pastor Sunday morning when he's preparing to stand before people and speak on God's behalf. Now, let me tell you, some people probably take it very lightly, but someone that's serious about doing what God has called him to do takes it very seriously, and it always means self-assessment. Am I doing this just because I like to do it? Am I doing it because I want people to like me? Am I doing it because I want to be important and people to look up to me? I'm standing in a pulpit, you know, looking down on everybody else. I want them looking up at me because I'm such a great person. There are all kinds of wrong motivations for doing what seem to be very good things. And let me tell you, with every person, there's at least some of that left in there. It takes some degree of arrogance to sit and say, God, I am God's man. He's appointed me to preach his word. Not something anyone can take lightly. And I will say this to you this morning. It puts fear in me because I believe this, that above all people, those who have done what they've done, not for the glory of God, but for their own glory, what they've done wrongly, saying that they're doing it for God when in fact they're not doing it for God, they are the people that are he's going to be the maddest at when they come face to face with him. You stood in my place and you spoke on my behalf and you lied. You stood in my place and you spoke on my behalf and you misled people by teaching them wrongly. I don't know about you guys, but for me, what I am hoping and I'm praying for, and if I hear this, everything will be fine. And what I want more than anything is to hear those words, "Well done, my good and faithful servant." That's where we need to be. Not cocky, not prideful, not puffed up. Humble. Next week, we will be beginning into chapter 9. Actually, chapter 11. Okay? So if you would like, it would not hurt to read through that chapter before you come to church next Sunday. So we're a little prepared to do it.